Hey, Cliff Goldstein here. A few centuries ago, a British philosopher and theologian named William Paley wrote an essay in which he talked about somebody, some dude's walking through the woods and he hits his foot against a stone or something. And if he had asked how the stone had gotten there, if he would have said that, it wouldn't have been totally absurd to believe that the stone had been there forever. It just always was. Now, I think, just remember, this was about a century or two ago, and people believed the universe had always existed then. Now, I think that answer is somewhat problematic in itself. I mean, after all, how could a stone, it's made up of atoms, and it's got all these forces holding it together, following natural laws. I don't think it could have, the answer is that it was there forever is a valid answer. But I don't want to get into that now. I want to move in another direction. And I think that this direction that I want to go into has some important implications for the concept of who those of us who believe in God and who believe that the world we live in has some, that the universe isn't sufficiently self-explanatory, that there's something beyond. It was a philosopher named Martin Heidegger once said, only a God can save us. And I think he's right, but that's another topic as well. Anyway, let's go back to our walk in the woods. So this guy's walking in the woods and he walks along and he sees a stone and, you know, whatever. Now, Paley's argument was, suppose though he's walking in the woods, and this is a known argument, and instead of walking in the woods, he sees a watch. Okay, and here's what Paley wrote. But suppose I had found a watch on the ground, and it should be inquired how the watch happened to be in that place. I should hardly think of the answer which I had before given, that for anything I knew, the watch might have always been there. Yet why should not this answer serve for the watch as well as for the stone? Why is it not admissible in the second case as in the first? For this reason and for no other, namely, that when we come to inspect the watch, we perceive what we cannot discern in the stone. And here's where I somewhat disagree. That is, several parts are framed and put together for a purpose. They are so formed and adjusted as to produce motion, and that motion so regulated as to point out the hour of the day, that if different parts had been differently shaped from what they are, or placed after any other manner or in any other order than which they had been placed, either no motion at all would have been carried on the machine, and none which would have answered the use that it now served by it. Okay. The bottom line, it's the old argument, it's known, is that the watch shows some irrefutable evidence of design, of a purpose. He saw purpose in the watch and design that led him to think the watch just couldn't have always been there, but something or somebody had to purposely put it together. Now, as I said, this isn't anything new. This is what's known as the teleological argument for the existence of God. Teleos, from the Greek word teleos, which gives the idea of completion or purpose. There was an end, a completion in mind when the thing was made. It's otherwise known as somewhat from the argument of design, and it's sort of the backbone of what's known as the intelligent design movement in America, which basically says, look, you look around, we see so much person, so much completion, so much teleos in nature, in the creation, that it just logically and reasonably points to a designer, an intelligent designer, a god or gods of some sort. And it's, sir, as I said, this isn't anything new. Even Voltaire, the horrific Voltaire, argued once that every watch must have a watchmaker, and so by analogy he was saying the world, which is so much more complicated than a watch, must have had a creator. And you can find this same thing in ancient writings in one form or another, in secular. Even the Apostle Paul once said that the argument for a creator is so apparent in the created world that those who reject God will be without excuse in the end time, because so much about God has been revealed in the created world. In fact, for many people, this argument from design, this argument for creation, is probably for many the strongest argument for the existence of God. And in many ways, it becomes even stronger over the centuries, because the more and more we explore nature, the more and more we see things that have a complication that 100 years ago would have boggled their minds. You know, it's funny, I was in the doctor's office the other day, and I had a chart of an ear. And this is just a plain old ear, and I looked at all the different parts. You got the outer ear formed, you know, made in a way to catch sound, and then it goes in the ear cavity, and then it goes to the ear drum, and this drum starts vibrating. Then they got those little three bones with a anvil stirrup or something like that, and the bone, and then these kind of send the vibration to this cochlea, which has got this fluid, and then the fluid turns the vibrations to electric signals, which are then carried through the brain. Now, this is, you know, this is a very simple explanation. It kind of reminds me of someone asked Woody Allen about War and Peace, what's it about? And he said, it's about Russia. That's how simple this is about explaining the ear. It's so much more complicated than this. It's so much more complicated. And again, the idea is if I look at my ear and I look at the, you know, everything, the drum and all that, maybe it was all by chance, but it sure looks like it was designed. I mean, I think any rational person looking at the ear, looking at all the different parts fitting together, I don't think it's absurd. It's a grand, grand leap to somehow think that this was designed. And that's just the ear, for crying out loud. I mean, get to the eye. I mean, the ear is crude in contrast to the eye. So again, the point, one can look at the ear or look at the eye or look at a gold watch on the ground. They could come away with the conclusion, and it's a reasonable conclusion, that they're not here by chance, that they were created with a purpose. There was an end. Hence, we have what's known as basically the theological argument for the existence of God. Now, I'll be the first to admit, this is not absolute proof. I mean, if it was absolute proof, I wouldn't have to be standing here. I wouldn't even be wasting my time. Everybody could look and see, oh, it's so obvious, and boom, that's it. It's not absolute proof. If I had absolute proof for the existence of God, I wouldn't need to be doing this show. And anyway, any one of those who argued, now, it's not a flawless argument, and one of those who argued against the teleological argument was a Scottish philosopher named David Hume. And Hume lived in the 18th century. Now, what was Hume's argument and how valid was it? And how could it be answered if it could be answered at all? Okay? Now, Hume was someone who was interested in what's known as epistemology. It's kind of a fancy philosophical term for the study of knowledge. I've said this on the show before. When we say we know something, what do we mean? I say that I know I'm in Silver Spring, Maryland, like now. Is that the same as when I say I know I got a backache? Or is that the same as I know that Hannibal Barca crossed the Alps and made life miserable for the Romans for a number of years? I use the same word know each time, but I used it in different ways. And epistemology is simply the study of the different way we use the term. Of course, now you run into a slight problem, though, when you do studies like this. Because by studying how we know something, we have to use a certain method to come to our topic. And yet if our whole study is on the very topic of how do we come to know anything, then we're kind of dead in the water right from the start. Because we have to have some method of knowing whatever we learn in epistemology. You see what I'm saying? It's just like it becomes redundant. How do we know that we are learning about knowledge is correct when the very thing we're trying to come, the very question is how do we know anything? It's sort of like using the methods of postmodernism to judge postmodernism. But forget it, that's a whole other topic. I don't want to get sucked into that right now. But anyway, David Hume was labeled an empiricist. And this means he's the kind of philosophers who believe that everything comes from what we see with our senses, our experience of the world, from how the world appears to us, which, and Hume would admit, is fairly problematic because we all know the world of our sense perceptions can be very deceiving and very limited. I mean, let's look at, you know, I mean, our senses can be deceptive. Let's look at this a little further. Hume divided all knowledge into two basic camps. The first is what's known as ideals of relationship. And this goes under a whole bunch of other names and philosophical, you know, they might, professional philosophers might differentiate them, but it's known as a priori truth or analytic truth or necessary truths. These are facts, and I put the word facts in quotes for a reason that are necessary by the way the meaning of the words are used. But that's another, let me go into this a little more. What do I mean? If I have the phrase, bachelors are unmarried, triangles have angles that equal 180 degrees, or you look at some of the truths of algebra and math, these are truths that exist purely by the definitions of the terms. These are truths that I don't have to use my eyes and ears to know. You know, it'd be like this. It would be like someone coming and saying to me, 6 is greater than 3. And then I'd say, I don't believe you. Let me see it with my own eyes. I mean, you'd think there was something wrong with me. By definition alone, without having to look at anything, I know that 6 is greater than 3. If I said to you, John's a bachelor, which means he doesn't have a wife, and you said to Lee, I want to see for myself that if John's a bachelor, he doesn't have a wife, again, you'd have a problem with me. Because by definition alone, we know that if John is a bachelor, that means he doesn't have a wife, period. This is true in all possible worlds. Now, these are truths that supposedly, and that's a whole other story, supposedly them not being true would be inconceivable, or the opposite of them would be nonsensical. These are truths that exist purely by definition. It would be as if someone were to say, oh, I know a married bachelor. It would make no sense because of how we understand the use of those terms. So that's ideals of relationship. That's one thing Hume said. In contrast to these truths, these a priori truths, these analytic truths, Hume talked about what he calls statements of fact, things that we can know only because we see them. These are so-called, again, I believe distinctions can be made among them, a posteriori or analytic or contingent truths. These are truths which are synthetic. These are truths which we see in the world itself, and they are not absolutely necessary. I mean, for instance, if I say that the sun rises in the east, now that's a truth we know because we get up in the morning and we see the sun rise in the east. But it's not an absolutely necessary truth. Cannot our solar system have been made differently with the earth spinning in the opposite direction, that instead of it spinning east, it spun west, then the sun would rise in the west? I mean, it's not impossible to conceive of a world where that could happen. To say that the sun could rise in the west is not to state what's absolutely logically inconceivable. If I say that Bill Clinton has white hair, I say that because I've seen pictures of Bill Clinton and his hair is white. There's nothing in the very definition of Bill Clinton itself which demands a priori that he have white hair. It's possible that Bill Clinton could have black hair. Or if I say John Lennon and Paul McCartney wrote Hey Jude, that's not a necessary truth. It's very possible we could have lived in a world where John Lennon and Paul McCartney didn't write a song called Hey Jude. These kind of truth, the sun rising in the east, Clinton having white hair, Lennon and McCartney writing Hey Jude, are not necessary truths. They are not truths that exist by the definition used. They are things that could possibly not have been truth. See, look at this. I drop the book and it falls. Now, it's not a necessary truth that every time I drop it, it falls on the table. Suppose someone had invented an anti-gravity machine, and they were zapping the GC with it, and I threw the book. Instead of the book going down, it would go up. That's not inconceivable. Or I suppose I was in the space station. Okay, I could drop the book, and instead of it going down, it would float off. In other words, it's not absolutely necessary, the thinking goes, that this book would fall on the table. Let me give you one last example to differentiate between what Hume would call ideals of relation and statements of fact. If I told you I've drawn a red circle on a sheet of paper, let's say I had a blackboard here and I drew a red circle. Now, you would know by definition that the circle would have to be round. Okay? That's an ideal of statement. It's an ideal of fact. It's an ideal of relationship, because merely by saying circle, it has to be round. But it doesn't have to be red. You have to look at it to know that it was red, not to know that it was round. That it was red would be a statement of fact. Anyway, you got these two distinctions. You got ideals of relationship, which are truths that have to be by the very nature of reality. And then you've got statements of fact, which are things we see. Okay, now Hume didn't invent this distinction. He just, as we'll see, took it to a new level. Now, I don't want to get into it all now, but the interesting thing is this whole distinction, this has been a strong foundation of philosophy, this a priori and the synthetic and analytic truth, and that, you know, whole philosophical systems have been based on that. But many believe it's not true, that the whole difference, it's not even a real distinction. In fact, in 1951, a philosopher named Willard V. Quine wrote a paper called The Two Dogmas of Empiricism that basically destroyed this whole idea of necessary truths as defined solely by definition. Because he said definitions are just words. Words are mere human conventions. They're contingent and not absolute. I mean, you know, you always had this idea that Euclidean geometry was absolute a priori. Well, now we know that Euclidean geometry doesn't even explain the world real world. And even many of the supposed absolute truths of simple mathematics, which were supposed to be a priori, are not as once believed. And this whole system Supposedly this truth has been wiped out. And that's another talk that I'm going to do. Now, but funny, before we continue, I just want to say one other thing about this. This whole analytic, synthetic distinction and all that. I mean, the philosopher Immanuel Kant built a whole philosophical system on this. You know, Kant had great influence on Hegel, who influenced Feuerbach, who influenced Marx, who we know influenced the whole world. And yet the bottom line is, that whole distinction has been destroyed, and that whole foundation of all that was wiped out. And I just think that's kind of funny. But anyway, that's a whole other spiel. The bottom line is Hume worked on this distinction. And I guess from our perspective, it doesn't matter if distinction works or not. In fact, I suppose Hume would say it's even better. It makes no difference, because his focus was really on contingent truths, on those truths that don't have to be true. And that's what I want to look at here. Now, let's come back to me dropping this book on the table. As we saw, as I said, it's possible that my letting the book go didn't mean it would necessarily have to drop. In other words, it's not inconceivable that if I let it go, it could have hovered in the air or even gone up. Now, for Hume, this is very important. He argued, though, and now listen to this, he argued, though, that even though I let the book drop, and even though I can be certain that it's going to fall, I don't have absolute certainty that it's going to fall. The fact that it always did doesn't mean anything absolute. It doesn't mean that my letting go of the book was the cause of it falling. See, Hume said, all I see is what he called a constant conjunction. The fact that every time I let go of the book, it falls. You know, the fact that one always followed the other, it was no certainty that my letting go of it was the cause of it falling. Instead, he said, the only reason we link the two together is, it's a custom, it's a habit. I have a habit, I'm used to it, I have the custom. When I drop something in the air, it always tends to fall to the ground. And so we automatically assume that one absolutely has to follow the other. But he asserts there's no real causal link. All you have is the sense impression. Remember, Hume was an empiricist. All you have is the sense impression that every time I open the book, it falls. That's all we know. We can't know for sure that the fact of me opening my fingers and dropping the book caused the books to fall. In fact, according to Hume, we can never, in any case, know cause and effect. He says all we can know is the constant conjunction of sense impressions, one thing following after another. His argument kind of reminds me of the tobacco companies a little bit. You know, they're always arguing about cancer, you know, tobacco, and you know, you're smoking, and you go and you show, well, the smoking causes this. And they say, well, okay, but what causes that? Well, we don't know yet. So they said, oh, you got no proof that it causes it. Well, then they go in and they go a little deeper and they say, oh, yes, well, this tobacco causes it at this level. But why that? And they said, well, we don't know. Oh, you don't know. And they go on and on and on and on and on. They keep going. So in the end, the tobacco companies are basically arguing you can't prove that smoking is bad for your health because you can't know it at the absolute level. And this is sort of what's known as Humean skepticism. And this is the philosophical background that when we work with David Hume. Now, before we look very closely at this argument, because remember, we're looking at the theological argument for the existence of God, the argument from design. Let's recap what we see with Hume. You see, we got a guy here who can't tell for sure that me opening my hand and letting the book fall is the cause of the book falling. In other words, if he's going to argue against this, against the idea that my opening hand causes the book to fall, imagine how hard it's going to be with the watch analogy that we first looked at, the idea of needing a creator. If he's going to diss the link between this and that, then I think he's going to have a hard time necessarily seeing a link between a creation and a creator. Now, that's basically the gist of Hume, and his argument against the theological argument goes something like this. Now, Hume's basic skepticism boils down to this, and he's got a quote in his book, and I just want to real quick read it. He says here, "Let us become thoroughly sensible of the weakness, blindness, and narrow limits of human reason. Let us duly consider its uncertainty and endless contradictions, even in subjects of common life and practice. Let the errors and deceit of our very senses be sent before us, the insuperable difficulties which attend first principles in all systems." Then he goes on and on and on. And his point's a good one. The bottom line of what he's saying is No matter what we believe, no matter what we know, there's all contradictions, there's problems, there's things we don't understand. And I agree with him. Now, he takes that and he goes to the argument of design. And this is what he argues against, the argument of design. Okay, instead of using a watch, he's using a house here, but it's the same thing. If we see a house, we conclude with the greatest certainty that it had an architect or builder, because this is precisely that species of effect which we have experienced to proceed from that species of cause. But surely you will not affirm that the universe bears such a resemblance to a house, or say a watch, that we can with the same certainty infer a similar cause, or that the analogy here is perfect and entire. Okay, what's he saying? Okay, and I think it's a valid point to a degree. He's saying just because you see a house which clearly has a design, which, you know, you can't move from a house to the universe or from a watch to the universe. I mean, that's the gist of his argument. Just because a house or a watch clearly shows evidence of design, we're not logically justified in moving from these to the universe, which is why he said the analogy falls apart and it's no good. Well, all right. I mean, fair enough. I mean, the universe isn't a house or a watch isn't a universe. So how, though, valid is his argument? I mean, he's got a point. Well, let's look at it this way. Suppose you're walking through the woods, and instead of finding a gold watch, you find a silver watch. The same watch as the other one, only instead of it being gold, it was silver. Does the existence of a silver watch imply a designer, as does the gold watch? I think it does. But now to something, though. It's not a gold watch, it's a silver watch. That is, it's not the same thing as a gold watch, it's different than the gold watch. Yet what justifies us in saying that it has a creator if it's not the same thing as a gold watch? Why do we say the gold watch does, and how can we infer from that the silver one? Well, it's the evidence of design. It's not the fact that it's a watch that matters. It's not the fact that one is gold, or it's not the fact that it's silver or gold or whatever. It's the fact of its design. That's the key issue here. It's design. Now, let's go along. You're walking through the woods, and suppose if instead of a silver watch, you see a steel watch, and that watch was very different from the others. You know, the gold and silver were very much similar. Would you be justified in assuming that it had a designer as you would with the gold watch? After all, it's not gold, it's not silver, it's something pretty different. Perhaps the gold watch was a regular wind-up pocket watch and the steel watch was a digital one with red letters. Again, no one would question that a steel watch had a designer, even though it was radically different from the others. Why? A steel gold watch isn't a gold wind-up watch. Just as well as the universe isn't a house, right? Well, I think so. So you see, the issue here isn't how close one watch is to the other. That's irrelevant. The issue instead is a designer that's inferred from the design. The gold wind-up watch, just like the steel watch, just like the house, or just like the universe, I might add, all imply purpose or design. I mean, suppose you're walking along, and instead of you finding a watch, you find a wind-up Barbie doll. Would you be justified in believing it had a designer as you did with the gold watch? Again, but remember, this is a wind-up Barbie doll. This isn't even close to a gold watch. It's a totally different thing altogether. What link do you have between a Barbie doll and a gold watch? They're totally different. But yet there's one thing they have in common. One thing that the gold watch and a wind-up Barbie doll have in common if you find them on the ground, and that is evidence of a pre-planned design. Now, I could go on. Suppose instead of a Barbie doll, suppose I found a plastic puppy dog. Okay, you're walking along, there's a gold watch, there's a silver watch, there's a steel watch, there's a wind-up Barbie doll, okay, each one of them. And then you got a plastic puppy dog. Okay, just a plastic thing. You squeeze it and it barks or whatever, I don't know. Would you be justified in assuming it had a designer? Yes, but it's, you know, a plastic puppy dog is radically different than a gold watch. It's radically different than a silver watch. It's radically different than a steel watch. It's radically different than a plastic wind-up Barbie doll. Okay, but again, it's not what it is. It's the evidence of design. Now, suppose though, instead of a plastic puppy dog, I found a live puppy dog. Okay, my one. That's infinitely more designed, infinitely more complex, infinitely more intricate than a plastic puppy one. Am I not right in seeing a designer there? I mean, let's be reasonable, folks. If a plastic puppy dog needed a designer, how much more so a flesh and blood sniffing, snorting, and chewing real one? So can you see what, in a sense, why Hume's argument that a house or a gold watch isn't the universe falls apart? A gold watch isn't a silver watch, isn't a steel watch, isn't a wind-up Barbie doll, isn't a plastic puppy dog, isn't even a real puppy dog, but that's irrelevant. All those things, like the gold watch, have evidence of design, and had each one is justified in each case of arguing for a designer. Can you see the point here? Please, if a single puppy dog brings evidence for a designer, how much more so for a universe which contains that puppy dog, the universe out of which that puppy dog arose and sustains it? Can you see he's arguing, well, the universe isn't a gold watch. I agree, the universe isn't a house, but a universe and a house both have design. No one is saying that the house and the universe is the same thing. That's not the point. I suppose that's ultimately, see, what Hume is doing is he's coning in on the weakness there. And I guess every argument has a weakness. A gold watch is a house, isn't a universe. And therefore, you can't use the analogy. But the point is they show evidence of design. A single plant cell wall has more intricacy than a gold watch. And we're supposed to believe that the gold watch had a designer, but the cell, much less the universe, doesn't? That's the argument. It's all supposed to be there. I don't know. Maybe I just lack faith. Maybe I'm just a skeptic. I admit it. I'm having a crisis of faith here. I'm supposed to believe that a simple gold watch had a designer, but something so much more complicated, something so much more in-depth, such as the universe didn't? I don't know. Maybe I'm showing lack of faith. Can someone help me out there with my unbelief?